Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
Incomparable. Profound and minutely subtle, pervading the entire universe, revealing itself right here, right now. And yet, it is rarely experienced, even in hundreds, thousands, millions of eons. We can see this, listen to this, know and embrace this. May we completely understand and actualize this Tathagata's true meaning. Nice to see everybody. How's everyone out there? Our robotic brother over there. Donning with his new knee. So it's funny, every time we do the opening dharani, the opening dharani of the Dharma, it says the entire Buddha Dharma path. It says it so clearly. And it says it that rarely is this accomplished. Rarely do we experience this this moment-to-moment awareness, this living in this present life. And but we have this opportunity to see it here. We have this opportunity to listen to it here. We have this opportunity to actualize it and make it so now. And I think this is one of the greatest reminders for all of us, which to me is one of the Buddha's greatest reminders, is that is to simply remember these practices, simply remember these teachings. And the more that I practice that in my life, the more that they actually come to fruition, you know. They actually work, you know. So I did a writing on the Lankavatara Sutra, which is a really kind of an intense teaching. It's impossible to talk about the whole thing in one little hour or half hour, whatever we do. So this is more just like a bit of an outline, a bit of a invitation to for each of us to read it, if you like, to kind of dive into it. It's pretty intense. It's pretty difficult to read in some ways because it's so repetitious. And as the Buddha is outlining all of these interdependent causations, you know, it gets a lot. So I just started with this one piece. This isn't even the whole chapter. This is about one page of the whole chapter. So I'm going to read this. There's 108 of these factors that he points out here, that the Buddha points out. A statement about birth is about no birth. A statement about permanence is about no permanence. A statement about characteristics is about no characteristics. A statement about duration and differentiation is about no duration or differentiation. A statement about moments is about no moments. A statement about modes of reality is about no modes of reality. A statement about emptiness is about no emptiness. A statement about annihilation is about no annihilation. A statement about extremes is about no extremes. A statement about the middle is about no middle. A statement about eternity is about no eternity. A statement about conditions is about no conditions. A statement about cause is about no cause. A statement about passion is about no passion. A statement about desire is about no desire. A statement about expedience is about no expedience. A statement about skill is about no skill. A statement about purity is about no purity. A statement about reasoning is about no reasoning. A statement about illustration is about no illustration. A statement about disciples is about no disciples. A statement about masters is about no masters. A statement about lineage is about no lineage. A statement about the three paths is about no three paths. A statement about freedom from projections is about no freedom from projections. A statement about vows is about no vows. A statement about the three turnings is about no three turnings. A statement about appearances is about no appearances. A statement about existence is about no existence. A statement about inclusion is about no inclusion. A statement about the personal realization of Buddha knowledge is a statement about no personal realization of Buddha knowledge. A statement about delight in whatever is present is about no delight in whatever is present. A statement about lands is about no lands. A statement about dust modes is about no dust modes. A statement about water is about no water. A statement about bow lengths is about no bow lengths. A statement about elements is about elements. And he says, a bodhisattva on the path should contemplate these deeply. So I think you can see from the first, maybe the first three or four or five lines, it was just the same thing over and over, very repetitious. And the point to this whole sutra is that, the point of the Lankavatara Sutra is that our perceptions are distorted. And the minute that we talk about our perceptions, the minute that we try to explain our perceptions, we only share the distortions about them. To talk about water is to not be able to talk about water. You know, how do you experience water? By either jumping in a lake or drinking it, you know? And so this whole page that I just read is basically saying that no matter which way, no matter how well we say it, no matter how well we describe it, no matter how well you think about it, it will only be a fraction of the truth, if that, you know? And even if it's a fraction of the truth, you may get caught in the illusion of only that fraction. This is it! I can't tell you how many times I've read different teachings and go, oh my God, that's it right there. And then the next day I totally forgot about it. And just back to my old robotic self, you know. You know. So for me, the way that these teachings have always worked is in the experiential notion of them, the experiential awakening of them. That's it. That's the only way that I've ever faced myself is through an actual experience. I've either faced my illusions or I've faced my true self, you know. And I didn't know which one was going to awaken in that, you know. In Zen, this is a part of why we do ritual, you know. Because as you take on the role of doing ritual, well, Seishin can probably talk about that tonight, is that the minute we're faced with it, what shows up? All of our stuff. Oh my God, you want me to do what? You know, I can't get up there and do that. I can't light the incense right. Did you see how Roshi lights? I can't light it like that. You know, this idea. And yet we're not asking you to light the incense like Roshi. We're asking Seishin to light the incense or to sound the han, you know? So this is the way that these teachings are here for us, to really awaken to what we are. But a lot of times what we awaken to first is the obstacles. The obstacles are what shows up first. Our hindrances, the afflictions show up. The fear, the anger, the worry, the anxiety, you know, the self. You know, and all its claws. It's got all these claws in us, you know. So this is the beauty of this teaching, is that and rightly so, it should be as difficult as it is, because the complexity of our minds, the complexity of the phenomenon of all life is so much. We say it in the opening of the Dharma. It's incomprehensible. It's minutely subtle. It's so difficult to see. It's so difficult to recognize it, you know. This is why a lot of times when we sit down for a meal in silence and we're instructed to eat very slowly, you know, you take one bite at a time and you put your spoon down. For a lot of us, including myself, it was the first time I ever really tasted food, that I ever experienced, like, oh my God, I can feel everything. I can taste every little morsel, you know? And this is the way that we start to awaken to this larger world instead of my small bubble. My bubble is, you know, think about just, I won't, I always have kind of maybe a gross idea of what the mind can be like, the polluted mind. Sometimes I call it a toilet, you know? And you just imagine what goes into a toilet. So, if we are to really awaken to what this Buddha Dharma is talking about, we have to move out of this shell. You know, that's why community is so powerful, because when you come to community, you step out of the comfort zone. You step out of this little, like, ugh, I don't want to do that. And you step into the wonder of it, you know. When we consider perception, we automatically say there's the perceived and the perceiver, or the perceiver and the perceived. Me seeing you, me seeing it, you know. But from the Buddha's insight, he found this to be completely untrue. In Zen, we say it's not two. There's not two. There's not a perceived and a perceiver. It's the dance of life, the whole thing. It's like saying that I can sit here and be free from oxygen. I can't. And yet I can't see the oxygen. I don't feel it entering my body. You know I breathe, but that's it. I don't feel the life force until what happens? It's taken away from you. So Zen states it from this place of not two. There is not the perceived and the perceiver. It is this totality of existence operating. The phenomena is arising, phenomena is arising, all this. What we perceive from the egoic mind is polluted by the very mind, polluted by ignorance, greed, and anger, and also our own individual karmas. And in this context, you can use karma as like whatever your particular flavor is, you know? Whatever that thing that grabs you every single time and messes you up, that's your karma. That's your flavor, you know? And sometimes it's easy to recognize, it's not always easy to recognize, but we all have our own afflictions. They may be common in nature, but each one of us has our own to take care of, you know. So you can try this example of perception. So the next time you look at a flower or a tree, just simply recognize all of the descriptions that come up in your mind. You recognize tall, short, beautiful, ugly, yellow, red, blue, you know, whatever descriptions come up. All of that stuff is added to. We place that on the flower instead of just witnessing the flower, just observing the flower. If a child were to look, before the child was taught words and descriptions, we would probably find that the child would have something closer to wonder. Maybe ecstatic stimulation, like, you ever get the like goosebumps, you know? I think goosebumps is a good description of when there is no there is no words. We simply are experiencing the wonder of something, you know. And then the next time you look at a tree, try not to have those descriptions. See if you can recognize it. Try not to describe it. Try not to define it. At this point in our life, it's too late. We've conditioned ourselves perfectly for that. So the minute that I hear it, I go, ooh, the bell, I love the bell. You know. So instantaneously, I added a description, a definition to it. And so because the Buddha experienced this total shift, this enlightenment, his wisdom was immense. But if he had just stopped, like the story says, if he had just stopped and decided to never be a teacher, that's how the story goes. He just had this wild experience, and he had no desire to be a teacher, you know. He just had this thrill of like, oh my God, I live in a new world, you know. If he had never stepped into that role of becoming the Buddha, he would have never deepened that experience. That experience only deepened through working with others, through working in community, through working with his own karma, with his own afflictions, his own things. Just because he had his enlightenment didn't mean his afflictions went away. He just became hyper attentive to them. At least that's what they say. So it was through his mindful encounters and his lived experiences that he was able to complete the picture of this internal vision, this wisdom that he experienced, that became the Buddha Dharma. There's a beautiful book called Old Path, White Clouds, and it's a book by Thich Nhat Hanh. And he literally writes the whole story of the Buddha. It's really long. It's really, it's very detailed. And it really shows how, as the Buddha went along in this role of this teacher, his wisdom just grew and grew and grew and grew. You know, it was really wild. And it was all from this seed that had woken in him. So if we come back to this this teaching, this sutra is about recognizing all of the functions of this psyche, you know, and the functions of how it diverts us. The ego is so intelligent, it's so crafty, it can divert us every single time, or we can slowly become aware of its tricks, if you will, you know. So I used this analogy this morning, and for most people, if you see an apple fall off of a tree, we witness the end result. We witness the effect, which is the apple hitting the ground. But if we take a little further, there's a cause. The apple was ripe enough and it fell, or the wind was strong enough and it fell, or an animal shook it loose, whatever the case may be. So there was a cause. The apple was released from the branch and it fell. But then there's a third part, and the third part is all the branches that it hit on the way down. And so most of us in our life, we only recognize the effects of our messes. So we wind up just trying to take care of the symptoms rather than get to the cause, you know. And this whole sutra is about recognizing all of the steps, all of the stages of the causes, so that we can use something like anger. So a lot of people only recognize anger after we said something terrible, or we were hurt by something terrible, you know. But we were never able to see this whole chain of events that happened, from the letting go of the apple to the one branch. Maybe the one branch was an old resentment that I held on to, and it just showed up in this next person. They did something that reminded me of somebody else, and the resentment awoke. I started to tell the story, and now I attack them, you know. So it's this whole wild chain of events that happens, that when we start to really embrace this thing called awareness and this mindful way of seeing ourselves, we start to see these chains, these interdependent links, as the Buddha called it. And so this process for all of us is very similar, but the way that we all come to it is very different, you know. Maybe we all come to it from a place of suffering, or we come to it from a place of intrigue. I used to say that we either come to awakening through great effort or great suffering, you know. And I still in some ways believe that, you know. There's a great line, and it says, being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what defeated us, we begin to consider its common manifestations. That self, this egoic me, which the Buddha said is not real at all, you know. But being convinced that this self, manifested in various ways, was what defeated us, we consider its common manifestations. And so we start to look at these afflictions that we have, you know, we start to look at these strange hiccups, if you will. and then, of course, eventually we must come back to the tree, because if all I look at is all the branches, I'm still stuck in the second stage. I don't come back to the original cause. The original cause is this illusion of something we call ourselves, you know. For most of us, we still get caught in all the afflictions. And if I could just get rid of the afflictions, I would be perfect, you know. But then you would have to cut all the trees off the branches of the tree. And then you would just have a big dead stick, you know. So for me, it's like there is no removing of the afflictions. But it is very much the denial of their life force, if you will, if that makes sense. So instead of me feeding my afflictions, I learn to recognize them and I learn to set them aside all the time. They're always showing up. Oh my God, I still am this crazy hungry ghost all day long. I always want. I just want. In this sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha describes the processes by which one advances on the Bodhisattva path to a Buddha, which makes it a difficult sutra to comprehend and even more so to live. Red Pine, the writer, a Zen writer and a Zen monk, presents the same idea using the Zen metaphor of the difference between a cup of tea, the teachings, and tasting the tea, the practice. It is not sufficient to have the cup of tea in your hand. You must taste the tea. It is useful to think of the elements that make up the cup itself as the myriad concepts of Mahayana Buddhism, many of which are mentioned above. If the elements that make up the cup do not congeal smoothly into the form of a usable cup, the jumble of elements will not hold tea. Of course, most practitioners find that understanding this myriad of concepts in depth without the guidance of a master is extremely difficult. For the less accomplished, their cup might never hold tea, at least in their present lifetime. As bodhisattvas advance in their training, they find that tasting the tea is more difficult than molding the cup. So I know for myself that is very true. I was telling somebody the story of the time that I made the attempt to walk to the Zendo while our teacher was still alive. I asked Roshi one day if I could walk to the temple in my robes. And he said, absolutely not. And so I did it anyway. And because I've always been a bit rebellious. And I didn't do it to be rebellious, but I did it because I needed to know what it was like to be a monk in the world. I just sat in the zendo all the time. I sat in this little secluded place, and I didn't know what it was like to feel embarrassed of wearing the robes, because I was embarrassed to wear the robes. You know, my ego was like, you look like a fool. Who are, do you know who you are? Because I always looked at myself from the past, you know? And so I made this decision to walk from my home in Toms River to Chemung, which is about 42 miles or something, in my Vans, no less. So I obviously didn't have much experience walking long distances.
How much time you gave yourself for that walk?
Yeah.
How much time you gave
Oh,
yourself?
I knew I was going to take me. I was going to sleep on the road. That was my plan, because I knew it would take me at least a whole day to walk, 24 hours, you know. So anyway, I start walking early in the morning, and I'm immersed in this lived experience. All eyes are on me, you know. You stand out pretty well when you're walking down the street in monk's robes, you know. And so at first I was even just leaving my house, I was like, oh my God, I got my neighbors, you know, I'm gonna walk out in the also, but this experience was so important to me. So I stepped out onto the street and started walking. I almost got arrested by the police. I saw some friends that were driving a garbage truck. Like, all these things happen in this experience. And so finally, about maybe 12 or 13 miles into the walk, my feet were so blistered. I didn't stop walking, but I said to myself, if somebody stops and offers me a ride, then I'll take a ride. And actually, about 20, 30 minutes later, a young kid pulled up. I said, hey, you need a ride? I said, yeah, I do need a ride. And he said, you going to that monastery out in Chemung? I said, I am. He said, oh, I live right down the street. I'll give you a ride. And so he drove me right directly to the monastery, and I hobbled in. But I tell that story because it was my first real lived experience of trying to find out what this stuff is that I carry in me. You know? Because otherwise I'll make these robes something so special, and then I lose the magic of what they really are, you know? It's like trying to make my hair look really nice, but I got a giant bald spot up top. Like, it's this illusion that I'm placing on myself, you know? So I wanted to find out what this is, and that's been the driving force of my life. Even today, last week I did this big ceremony at a temple in upstate New York, and it's always crazy. I never know what to expect, you know. And my teacher was like, Genjo, you're gonna walk in front of everybody, and you're gonna start the procession. And I'm like, me? I don't want to do that. Okay, you know. And so I get to throw myself into these experiences, because that is the very essence of life, to taste all of it, you know. And when I do that, I realize that my fear is false. I find out that my pride isn't real. I find out that my worry is nonsense, you know. It's all this wind up in the attic. And the practice is the windows opening up so the wind can just pass through. Otherwise, it gets in there and it gets stale and things turn terrible, you know. That's what happens in our minds. When I don't know how to open these windows, these psychological and these metaphorical windows, things start to rot, you know. And then it really looks like an old, dirty toilet, you know. So like I said, the sutra is pretty intense. It's pretty difficult to read, but don't let that stop you.